Recently, I was having a conversation with my friend Sean about the opposition that we face as alternate historians when we go to discuss our ideas with new people. And the example that I kept bringing up was the peopling of the Americas. If you have an alternate history idea that requires a peopling of the Americas that's prior to about 12,000 years ago, you're going to find a lot of pushback from the general public. Most people still believe in the Clovis First Bering Land Bridge thing, even though that's been overturned for about 20 years. But anyone with an open mind that spends much time doing research into this sort of thing is quickly left with evidence of exactly the sort of contact that most dismiss as absurd. In fact, so much evidence exists, even the mainstream is fully admitting that there's no clear story of the peopling of the Americas, because the arguments against that hypothesis have withered on the vine in recent years, which has left fertile ground for new hypotheses to crop up, some more pseudoscientific than others, but all worth looking at. So let's look at the peopling of the Americas and find out just how different it is from what we learned in school. Hi, my name's Dan, and welcome to Dedunking. The question of where the first Americans came from popped up in the Western mind shortly after Columbus rediscovered the place. And most of these ideas were biblical in nature, lost tribes of Israel kind of stuff. But other ideas were out there too. For instance, the notion that they were descended from Atlantis or the like was popular, but academia ran with the mound builder myth as we know it today. This was the idea that there was some advanced civilization that gave rise to the tribes that lived near the mounds, the idea being Indian too dumb to move dirt. And this was mainstream as it gets, endorsed by the Smithsonian in 1847. It took another 33 years to see academics overturn this, and a few decades later, we had the Folsom First hypothesis. And if you haven't heard of that, it's basically Clovis First with a different arrowhead. The Folsom Toolkit is believed to be a descendant of the Clovis technology, but in the early 20th century, the belief that the first humans didn't arrive in the Americas until about 3,000 years ago, and that they used Folsom points, was the prevailing scientific position. In fact, much like we saw with Clovis First, if you were an archaeologist in the 1940s and you said, "I don't think the Folsom were the first people here, I think they were here before 3,000 years ago," expect to be professionally ostracized. But this was much worse in the Clovis First era. By the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, you had what they called the Clovis Mafia, the Clovis Police. Archaeologists and anthropologists labeled their own colleagues as such. Despite the hegemony and the old data being put on a pedestal, new data did keep coming in, and in 1997, a meeting at Monte Verde in Chile changed the consensus. Now the idea that people arrived in the Americas before the Clovis First hypothesis posits they did was accepted by the professionals. No longer was the idea of another group arriving before the Clovis people opposed out of hand. Instead, they were just viewed very skeptically for most people. I mean, the pseudo guys like Thor Heyerdahl and Graham Hancock, their hypotheses will always be rejected out of hand. But anyway, the point is, the Clovis First hypothesis really hinged on the separation of these ice sheets up in Beringia. And when the timeline showed that that wasn't when people first came over here, there was people before that, those other hypotheses started to pop up, and one of them was the Kelp Highway hypothesis. Now, in a nutshell, the Kelp Highway hypothesis claims that the reason we see old sites all over the west coast of the Americas is because the settlers used boats and hopped up and down the coast. They were said to have followed the fish and other sea resources that use kelp as a big part of their ecosystem, traveling down the coast quickly compared to what would be expected from land migration. Now, kelp was a huge resource to the early indigenous Americans on the West Coast, and in fact, right here in Washington State, the Salish-speaking people still help the state manage the kelp resource to this day. In fact, it's so versatile in barren coastal areas it can be used as firewood. So this hypothesis, it's robust. It not only explains how people could have arrived before the ice-free corridor opened up in Beringia, but it also explains how the entire western part of the continent could be settled in a relatively short period of time. Indeed, oftentimes the oldest sites seem to be further south than one would expect. While several sites like the Bluefish Caves exist far in the north, other places like White Sands is in New Mexico, Monte Verde is in Chile, and these are old-ass sites, so the idea that that area was initially settled by seafarers isn't really that far-fetched. And different kinds of kelp, you support different kinds of ecosystems. So if a group was living off of one kind of fish or whatever that the kelp supported, and then the ecosystem changed a little, they may have had to follow that kelp into a new area, forcing their migration. Now, just last month, in January of 2026, we had a paper published on the distribution of kelp in South America over the last 20,000 years. And in it, the authors show that the majority of the coast of Peru and Chile had kelp forest for eons now, long before the Younger Dryas climate change and after. In other words, a sort of oasis, a place of stability. And if you're a hunter-gatherer community, that's a really big deal. In fact, when you recognize that this is a huge part of their toolkit, kelp itself, all of a sudden, this makes a whole lot of sense that you would see a lot of people settle permanently around these kinds of areas. And you see a lot of the same things in different parts of the Western United States and South America. For example, in South America, you see cranial modification just like you see in the Pacific Northwest. Now, I've covered this in a video before, so I won't go into too much detail here, but in the Pacific Northwest, the Cascade Mountains marked a change in the culture of the Native American tribes. West of the Cascades, the natives without modified skulls were considered lowborn, slaves, or otherwise untouchable. The modification of the skulls of your offspring was a sign of freedom, a symbol of status that was the norm. In fact, the natives east of the Cascades called their cousins to the west flatheads because this practice was so common. This was recorded by so many European explorers, it's not debated. Again, I've covered this before. There's a link below if you're interested. The point is, if you look at Paracas, Peru, way down south there, we see that same practice. Now, I know many believe that some of the skulls in Paracas, Peru were not modified, that they're natural, they were born that way. But those aren't the skulls I'm discussing here. I'm talking about the practice of actual, head binding. But the other thing I want to point out here is, Nelson Rockefeller bought some of those skulls from Peru. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say he got the best, most anomalous, most natural ones, if such a thing is possible. Link is right there if you aren't aware of this stuff. But my point is there's a lot of evidence potentially for connections between the Pacific Northwest and Peru. They could have used the kelp to jump up and down. They both practice that cranial binding. And another thing that's interesting is in both of those areas, if you went to bury your ancestor, you would see your other ancestors. In the Pacific Northwest, they were buried either in canoes up off of the ground or in some situations in these weird teepees made of driftwood that were connected like these giant catacombs made of wood above ground. And in Peru, they were in caves, in burial bundles. But at any rate, you would see your ancestor when you buried dad or grandpa. So that may have had something to do with reinforcing this whole idea of a cultural connection between the groups. At any rate, it does seem very intriguing and quite possible that this didn't develop independently. Now, when the kelp highway hypothesis is brought up, often the peopling of Australia is mentioned. Now, this includes New Zealand too for those Kiwis out there, but the point is this has long been accepted that Australia was settled by boat. Now they say something like 65,000 years ago, in fact. So the idea that people were capable of making sea voyages in the Pacific, well, that's accepted, and it has been for at least a century. The journey to Australia from mainland Asia isn't that long. It's basically a series of short island hops, and sometimes you can see the next island before you leave. In other words, like the proposed kelp highway voyages, these are much different than the Contiki voyage Thor Heyerdahl took from Peru to the Roraima Atoll in 1947, which covered about 4,300 miles, traveled in 101 days. He did this with low tech and a small crew in order to demonstrate the possibility of such trips by ancient seafarers. And despite the evidence showing that people could make these long voyages in the open sea, the Contiki voyage has always been opposed by mainstream anthropologists and archaeologists because Thor was, well, he was not only proving their basic models had a potentially fundamental flaw, because he was looking for a lost people in Polynesia, a lost civilization, and of course, he believed these guys were white, so that's all it took. Now he's considered one of the bad guys by those who call alternate historians pseudoscientists as an insult, but his observations have been borne out in some cases. I mean, for example, he claimed that the Moai and the walls that the major Moai sit on look like they were associated with ancient Peruvian architecture, and this has been shown to be quite possible. Just last year, Easter Island was shown to have both sweet potato and ginger in its earliest habitats that we know of. In other words, that settlement shows contact between Easter Island, Asia, and South America, as ginger isn't found in the Americas and sweet potato was not found outside the Americas. Now, this is similar to what happened to a 19th century man who espoused some ideas that are clearly not cool by modern standards, Carl Christian Rafn. He was the first person to claim that the Vikings had discovered the Americas, and some of his evidence has been shown to be accurate. Some of his evidence consisted of dumb Indian can't scratch rock. So my point here is sometimes you can take some evidence from somebody and discard others and come up with an interesting hypothesis. And in those regards, Thor Heyerdahl's pretty interesting because he got people to look at Easter Island in a very different light. If you imagine the sea level is lower and then look at the Pacific, you'll see it's quite possible to have a large chain of islands jumping all the way from the Americas to Asia, with Easter Island kind of centrally located. Now, the first person that pointed this out to me was Matt Bell from the Limitless podcast. This line of now underwater peaks that runs from Easter Island to South America, and that even larger line of underwater mountains that stretches from Asia to that island, is very compelling to me. Because if the Earth had lower sea levels due to more water in the glaciers covering the planet, then these underwater mountains, they'd all be islands. In other words, if sea levels were lower, Easter Island wouldn't be some remote, all but inaccessible island. It would be one island in a chain that stretched from the east coast of Asia to the west coast of South America. Similar to those coastal voyages that they talk about in the Kelp Highway Hypothesis, this would be a series of island jumps. Very simple, and many times, again, you'd be able to see that next island. And given human curiosity, if they have the means, they're probably going to go there. Now, this explains why there's a large genetic difference between ancient Americans in the North and South. Different peoples traveled to South America, both from the North and Southern part of the Pacific, in my estimation, and DNA seems to bear out this idea. Just last year, a paper published on the native pre-contact Easter Island people, there was both Polynesian-ish DNA and a small but detectable amount of DNA from South America. And this South American DNA actually spreads out into the Pacific Islands, leaving Easter Island and traveling beyond. Now, obviously, this is a very good piece of evidence for the hypothesis that Easter Island was part of a well-traveled sea route, but this doesn't explain the long period of time between the last time sea levels were low enough to expose this chain of islands and the earliest settlements we have found on that island. But this could be explained by the myth of how it was settled. The chief of the tribe sent explorers out to find the island, and when they found it, they returned to the leader, and he organized an expedition to gather supplies and eventually brought hundreds of people to this place, this holy place. And perhaps they brought them there because of the Axis Mundi, or Omphalos on Easter Island, the world navel, a common feature in the ancient world. You know, Greece, India, Israel, Peru, lots of cultures are said to have had this idea, a stone that was the center of creation, the first place that God power touched the earth and creation spread out, and it connects the overworld, this world, and the underworld. Now, these places have always been located in population centers, but not on Easter Island. We see it on a far-flung corner of the ancient world, but not so far-flung if you assume those islands are populated. Then it's even central. It could even be called the last waypoint before traveling across to the East Pacific Rise. That's this chunk right here where the tectonic plates do their thing. And that would have made this the longest place of this hypothetical journey, a sensible area to locate the center of your culture. And this could explain why they looked for that island. Perhaps it was their center of creation, sacred and irreplaceable. Geologist Robert Schock has made an observation that dovetails nicely here. According to Professor Schock, many of the partially buried moai on the island look to have been slowly covered over the course of tens of thousands of years. It seems very plausible a seafaring culture was centered on Easter Island and visited Asia and South America regularly enough that they used foodstuffs from both places. And assuming the seafarers brought trade stuffs with them, the places that they stopped to visit would be very invested in having them come again and again and again, perhaps even making, you know, some sort of symbol or a sign to, hey, we're here, park there. In Paracas, Peru, just 5 miles or so from the caves where hundreds of those famous elongated skulls were found, the Candelabra of the Andes faces the sea. Made of 2 to 3 foot deep trenches scratched into the dense, crusty desert sand, it is 600 feet tall and 200 feet wide. visible from the sea at over 12 miles away. Maybe it's unrelated, but then you've got to ask yourself, why'd they go through all this trouble for nothing when it looks to be a sign that says, hey, park your boats here, come trade with us here? And that would make a lot of sense, given the kelp highway hypothesis and other things we've seen so far in this video. Like I said, there's a ton of evidence that shows that the old school peopling of the Americas model is crap, is garbage, is junk. And all we've talked about so far is the West Coast. In 1970, this projectile point was found off the coast of Virginia by a scallop trawler. In 2004, Dennis Stanford, archaeologist and a bigwig at the Smithsonian, and Bruce Bradley, archaeologist for the University of Exeter, claimed this was a Solutrean point, and it does strongly resemble the Solutrean points, as you can see. Operating from the assumption that the Solutrean people, who are from Western Europe, not Virginia, made it to the Americas and left at least one arrowhead behind, Dennis and Bruce looked at the similarities between Clovis points and the Solutrean ones and came to the conclusion Clovis technology was derived from Solutrean technology. Now, the reasoning is sound. Both cultures used a form of working stone called lithic reduction percussion, and in particular a technique known as overshot flaking. Now, percussion is chipping away at a rock by hitting it with a hammer and punch, while overshot flaking is a technique that removes large sections from the stone across the full length, ideally from edge to edge, allowing for the quick removal of large pieces of unwanted stone. But more importantly, this allows for wide, flat blades, and this is really only seen in two cultures that use it a lot, the Clovis and the Solutrean. And the similarities don't end there. Both cultures used a strange bowed rod projectile thingy, not common in the other cultures, and they look related due to their shape and markings. Now, Clovis and Solutrean toolkits often had those bone spears in them. Again, we only see this with the Clovis and the Solutrean people, but neither one of them seems to have derived their technology from their ancestors. It's like both the Beringian and the earlier European tips all look way different than Clovis and Solutrean. And this has caused mainstream archaeologists to think that maybe it's convergent evolution.
On this first dendrogram comparing the types of tools in each group, you see that pre-Clovis is most similar to the Beringian Ushki early Jaktai cultures, and then those two and Mesa Sluiceway toolkits are more similar to each other than they are to the Nenana tool. What about the methods used to make those tools, though? Here's their dendrogram for the technological features, and it's pretty different. What this means is that Clovis and the mid to late French Solutrean are more similar to each other than either is to the technological tradition that came immediately before themselves. This pattern is exactly what convergent evolution looks like.
But to me, this is just one more example of polarized thinking. Either the Clovis technology was derived from Solutrean or it was not. But what happens if one Solutrean guy was washed up on shore of the Americas and he was a good flint knapper? And he introduces that technique to other people. They keep making whatever points they made before, but now they include overshot flaking. Just like when Native Americans had metal traded to them, they didn't start making trains and guns. They made arrowheads out of metal now. Just like if you introduce silk to a seamstress, she doesn't unlearn everything she knows. She just starts making stuff with silk. To me, it seems very, very likely, even as a matter of fact, more likely than it just being happenstance. Because let's be clear, those bone rods with overshot flaking, this is very, very unlikely to be seen together in the record.
To be perfectly honest, for two groups of people like Clovis and Solutrean to independently develop this specific set of toolmaking practices and toolkits on two different continents should not be a coincidence. The chances of that happening are astronomical. Both share quirks and idiosyncrasies that are extremely rare among stone toolmaking cultures.
There are a lot of other things that people bring up to demonstrate a connection between the old world and the new that I didn't cover here. In fact, shortly before the recording of this, a paper was published that announced the oldest dated clothing in the Americas, and possibly the world, was found in a cave in Oregon. Details of the way they weaved the plant and animal fibers together to make clothing are recognizable, thanks to the state of preservation. But in addition to scientific finds like this, we also have gossamers, rumors of light-skinned visitors, or even entire tribes, pottery that looks out of place, maps said to trace their origins to the Library of Alexandria, the old copper culture, which I've covered before, and the belief that that culture traded nearly pure copper to the Minoans to help fuel the Bronze Age, the navel-holding statues covering the entire globe, the Master of Beast iconography doing the same, the aforementioned belief in a navel of the world being stone. So many things it becomes impossible to cover all of the different possibilities, which is why I kept it to mostly things that science has discussed to a degree. The reason I didn't want to get too heavily into DNA is because they keep kicking the can, they keep changing it every couple of years, and what they said 2 years ago definitively is now being said, well, we don't know so much. There is definitely signals of admixture in the Americas that cannot be accounted for with the current peopling models. I'll say that much. And really, at the end of the day, as I've said so many times in the past, we need more data. We need more work done. We need open-minded work done. We can say with certainty, the learning about the peopling of the Americas has consistently faced setbacks from academia, from archaeology, from anthropology. And that kind of needs to stop so we can make some serious progress. Anyway, thank you so much for watching. I'm going to be in Sedona, Arizona, May 1st through 3rd. There are links to support the channel down below. Don't forget to like, subscribe, share with your friends, and I hope to see you next time.